Okay, this is 19th June 1984 at the IAU Symposium on SETI in Boston, and talking with Thomas Carr of the University of Florida. And before we get to your contact with radio astronomy, could I just ask you what your training was and then how you first came in contact with radio astronomy?
Right. You mean all the way back? Or?
Well, just very briefly, yes. Yeah.
Radio astronomy came about halfway through. Let's see, I went to the University of Florida and got my bachelor's and master's degrees in physics. And then I, during World War II, I worked at Aberdeen Proving Ground for 5 years. And then I went to the Bikini A-bomb tests right mm-hmm. after that. Then I worked for the Air Force for 5 years at Cape Canaveral, Air Force Missile Test Center. And after 5 years there, I figured 10 years in civil service was enough, so I decided to go back to the University of Florida and get my PhD degree.
I see.
So I went back in 1955, I believe it was, and I had just heard about radio astronomy and I wanted to do something in radio astronomy. Well, one of the professors there also wanted to get into radio astronomy, and that was Alex Smith. So I signed on as his graduate student, and together we picked out the decametric radiation from Jupiter that had just been discovered by Burke and Franklin.
Right.
In fact, there was an IEEE convention at Gainesville at that time, and Roger Gallet, I think, mm-hmm. from the High Altitude Observatory, gave one of the talks. After the talk, we asked Roger what a good thing to do in radio astronomy might be, and he says, why not start observing Jupiter? You can do it with very simple equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So we did. And
now, let me just ask you, you said you already were interested in radio astronomy and were looking for something within it.
Right.
How did the interest in radio astronomy, how was that kindled?
Oh, well, for the Air Force, I was working on missile tracking systems, instrumentation, and I like that sort of word. I was in on the testing of the early missile tracking systems.
So it was radar, basically, that got you interested.
Yeah, although we didn't finally go to radar frequencies, we went to very low frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
So I designed, and with the help of Colin Barrow, who was another student at that time, we built the first array at the University of Florida, 18 megahertz, and it consisted of 8 half-wave elements, an array of 8 half-wave elements. And within a few days after we tested it out, we got these enormous Jupiter swishes and crashes.
Right.
That was in December 1956.
Mm-hmm.
So the rest of that apparition, we observed Jupiter quite regularly on 18 megahertz, and that was the subject of our first
publication. The 1957 APJ paper.
Right.
But now you're doing this with, of course, one advantage of these kind of observations doesn't require a big group or a lot of money.
That's right.
Was that part of your restriction?
Oh, yeah. There was very, very little money available. And at this frequency, we could build the array out of wire and 2x4 posts and use an ordinary shortwave receiver for the receiver and found an old Esterline Angus recorder.
Right.
So we got started on a shoestring. Then we applied to the NSF after our first publication, we applied to NSF for grant support, and it came through, and we've been supported by NSF ever since.
Starting in 58, you mean?
Very 57, very I guess, our first grant. 57 or 58, I've forgotten mm-hmm. which.
And you did not have an astronomy background, so how was it that you began learning about Jupiter? You just began reading?
Well, I had a good physics background, and then right. I had experience in radio propagation and also missile tracking systems, radars.
So it was just a matter
CW
of,
radar.
It was just a matter of applying that to the Jovian
right.
Situation.
I had done graduate work in cosmic radiation.
I see.
Before that. So radio astronomy seemed to combine some of the things that attracted
sure.
me in cosmic radiation and made use of some technical skills that I had developed.
Sure. Well, let's take a look at that first paper where you, according to the abstracts that I've looked at, you established that the rotation period was somewhat different than the so-called System 2. Was that
yes.
the first indication? I don't remember.
No, we weren't the very first. I think Franklin and Burt found some evidence of that, but they were a little late publishing it. And the first evidence that the true rotation period might be different from System 2 that I came across was by Galilei himself.
Uh-huh.
Galilei showed quite definitely it was different. So stimulated by his work, we then showed very clearly that it was different by having three different years of data. The first year was the old data of Shane.
Right.
And the next 2 years, I believe, were our own measurements. And it was quite clear that it wasn't the two period.
This 57 paper says here only 1957 observations, so maybe that was another paper that where you had 2 years of data.
Oh, you're right. Let's see.
Getting a little bit
it
ahead.
Took 3 years to have an unambiguous indication that it wasn't what the rotation period was. So, I guess Burke and Franklin, yeah. The 3 years we used was Shane for 1955, Burke and Franklin for 19...
Or Shane for 50.
Shane for 50,
yeah,
Burke and Franklin
there.
For 55,
right.
And ours for 56, 57. Yeah, that was it.
Now, also in this abstract, it says that the ionosphere was approximately like the Earth's. Concluded that the Jovian ionosphere was probably like the Earth's, and this gets us into the question of what you thought was going on. Now, if you try to take yourself back to the beginning.
I've forgotten what we said.
Not to later ideas.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I'm afraid I can't tell you more than that.
Let's see.
Can you recall, which, independent of that paper, what your first ideas were as to how to attack the origin of the mechanism?
Well, let's see. With this paper by Carr, Smith, Peppel, and Barra, there we reported on a polarimeter. We built a polarimeter too. Burke and Franklin had shown that that the radiation was polarized. So we built a polarimeter, and sure enough, we found it was very heavily polarized. And somewhere along there, we said that there must be a magnetic field present. I think other people probably said that too.
Mm-hmm.
That the polarization is evidence of a magnetic field.
Sure.
And let's see, what else did we say? At some point in there, I made some rough calculations and said that the magnetic field strength on Jupiter must be about 10 Gauss. Now, my reasoning at the time was a little bit circuitous, but it turned out that it would be about the right value for the mm-hmm. field strength. I forgot what paper that was in.
You may be folding in some of the Smith and Carr 1959 APJ results.
Probably,
here,
yeah.
Where you talk about System 3.
I think so.
And the magnetic
field. I'm not
field.
Sure which things appear
yeah,
in which papers.
Sure, it's hard to remember after this long time. But you don't recall anything about an ionosphere. That was mentioned, like I say, in the abstract.
Yeah. I don't remember what we said about
that's
the
okay.
ionosphere.
Let me ask about why there were some articles published in the Journal of the British Astronomical Association.
Colin Barra, who is a Britisher, was getting his master's degree at the University of Florida at the time I was getting my PhD. And he helped build the first array, and he was in on the first observations.
And was he a former member or a current member of the BAA?
He was a member of the BAA. And so everything we did, he would send off reports of it to the BAA.
I see. Okay. That just seemed a little bit odd from Florida to England.
Yeah, that was the connection.
And the other thing I wanted to ask about was, I have here your 1958 thesis, Studies of Radio Frequency Radiations from Planets. So that was the PhD thesis.
Right.
Finally.
Yeah.
But now you also looked at other planets.
We did.
And what did you find?
We found absolutely nothing. We looked at Saturn, Uranus, and possibly
and
others.
And Venus
and
was
Venus,
mentioned.
Yeah. And we got no... Well, I think we said there might have been some events from Saturn, but we certainly
right, there was
clear of it.
There was one paper where you said sporadic Saturn radiation, apparently.
Yeah, I don't know how sure we were of it, but
right.
It's obviously rubbish. But I remember we made particularly good measurements of Uranus, and I'm not sure that they have been equal since then,
uh-huh.
and got it under the best possible conditions, although with a low-gain antenna, we found absolutely no possible events from Uranus.
Mm-hmm.
Just recently, we were making repeating Uranus observations with a very large array that covers 7 acres.
Uh-huh.
And we still don't get anything. That's so, particular interest now because Voyager is
because
approaching
Voyager's
Uranus.
Right.
Yeah.
And will it pick up the same kind of things as it did around Jupiter and so forth? Yeah. So after these initial results with the single frequency, apparently you moved on to multi-frequencies. Can you tell me how you expanded?
Yeah, first it was 18 megahertz, and then we added another array for 22.2 megahertz. Then we added the polar emitter for 22.2 megahertz. Then we added a Yagi for 27.6 megahertz. About that time, we branched out into Chile.
And what was the reason for doing that?
Well, one of the original reasons was that when it's summertime in the northern hemisphere and conditions are bad because of the lightning disturbance, it's wintertime in Chile. And also half the time Jupiter's overhead in Chile, and the other half the time it's overhead in the northern hemisphere.
Oh, in terms of moving up and down in declination.
Right, 12-year period. So there was a Chilean graduate student at the University of Florida at that time. He was a friend of mine, and I told him we wanted another station in the opposite hemisphere, and he said, why not try Chile? He gave me the name of the director of the National Observatory of Chile, Señor Federico Rutland, and I wrote to him, and sure enough, he was interested. So Alex Smith and I, with NSF support, went down there and helped start what is known as the Maipú Radio Astronomical Observatory
at
the
University
of Chile.
What year was that now?
This was 1958, I guess, or 9, I've forgotten which.
So 2 or 3 years after you began.
Right. And we built it up from scratch, and it was a lot of fun. And we got the thing working, and the Chilean people were most enthusiastic, and they were very capable. A lot of electrical engineers present. And they have run the observatory since. It's increased in size by a considerable margin.
Another motivation that seemed to me from the abstracts was that you could thereby distinguish ionospheric effects on the Earth intrinsic effects.
Sure. We could get simultaneous measurements from both hemispheres. And we found that sometimes we'd get a strong storm in Florida and be getting nothing in Chile. Sometimes we'd get a strong storm in Chile and nothing in Florida, which means the ionosphere was suppressing it in one place or the other by some sort of destructive interference.
So basically, only common things were believed as being of true Jovian origin.
And then later on, of course, we developed interferometers between the two stations, long baseline interferometers.
That's getting into the mid-60s?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
Yeah. You also did work, it appears, statistical kind of work, trying to correlate the occurrence of the Jupiter bursts with other things.
With solar activity.
Right.
We spent a lot of time on that and never got any results, any positive results at all.
Well, one paper talked about that you had a definite number of hours delay between geomagnetic
things,
8-day delay.
Yes.
Did that
the
not
8-day
pan out
delay?
That was an abstract.
That was on a limited number of events. And later on, we found that those were Io-related events, and those just happened to be times when Io was favorable to trigger the Jupiter emissions, and the fact that they appeared to correlate with solar storms was coincidental.
What was the term you were using?
Io, you know, Jupiter's moon.
Oh, Io. Oh, sorry.
Its position has a strong effect.
This was before that was established.
Before it had been discovered.
Right.
Yeah, we mentioned in our early papers about the 8-day effect. Jupiter storms would appear to recur at 8-day intervals. And later, that was shown to be some sort of effect due to the beating of the Earth's rotation period, Io's orbital period, and Jupiter's rotation period after the Io effect had been discovered. But that came later. Big made that discovery.
In retrospect, was the Io signal in your data?
Oh, sure. We were getting, if we'd been a little smarter, we would have recognized it right off the bat. It was the most prominent feature of the data, the Io-controlled storms. Mm-hmm. Of course, we saw the storms, but we didn't know that Io was the one that was triggering.
But it's such an unexpected thing.
That's right.
In retrospect, we said, to have a satellite.
Other people who had come into the field, too, right after we set up our first observatory. Of course, Smith and Douglas at Yale started theirs.
Right.
And then after that, Jim Warwick came in. So that was the sequence of the people making these observations. First, Burke and Franklin. Then Shane found that he had a lot of data from 5 years back. Then Gallet did a lot for a year or two and then stopped. And then we, and then Smith and Douglas, and then Warwick.
Mm-hmm. From what you've just mentioned, this is almost entirely an American operation in the beginning. Any particular reasons you see why that was?
Well, of course, the Australians. Shane's Australian.
Well, yes, but he only looked at his old data. Nobody set up and started looking at Jupiter. Nobody in England did. Nobody in Europe did.
Europe is a little far north, I guess. Yeah, you can't. Their observing season is much more limited there.
That's true.
Because Jupiter's a southerly affair. And at these low frequencies, it makes a difference when something's not close to the zenith. Mm-hmm. It's harder to observe down low on the horizon. Well, let's see, what else?
I mean, did it become an American specialty in some sense?
I guess, that's right. Except for Shane's finding it in his old data, it was. Shane would have continued, except that he died.
Right. Am I correct in a feeling I've gotten that this Jupiter work was certainly part of radio astronomy, but sort of not in the mainstream? It was sort of something on the side.
Well, this was the first detection of planetary radio emission. So, right at the first, it was in the mainstream. I mean, a lot of people were interested in it, but not too many people were doing it. All kinds of people were interested in our results.
Yeah.
People like George Field and people who are big names in other branches now.
Well, perhaps I'm saying this because I see the U.S. has been rather weak in radio astronomy until the late 50s, early 60s. And yet in this field, it's the primary place where research groups are working on this. And so you're not talking with Jodrell Bank, with Cambridge,
right,
with radio physics.
Well, this is certainly an offshoot, always has been an offshoot of radio astronomy because it's such a low frequency.
That's also
true. Most radio astronomers don't like to work down at those frequencies.
Even then it was a low frequency. Yeah.
Right. There are all kinds of special obstacles to be overcome at these very low frequencies due to the ionosphere.
Well, up until 61, what would you say was the main thing we learned about, or 62, somewhere around that era, that we learned about Jupiter from all of this?
Well, of course, first thing was that the radio, the probability of occurrence of the noise storms was correlated with Jupiter's rotation period and provided the most accurate way of measuring Jupiter's rotation period, since you can't see the solid surface. And as the years went by, we refined the period more and more, and we're still doing it.
Did that surprise people to have this different rate?
Yes. The so-called System 3, which is the radio period, had never been thought about and never been dreamed of. It was only System 1 and System 2 up to that point.
But what I'm getting at, though, did it fundamentally change ideas about the nature of the Jovian atmosphere and core and so forth?
Well, what it is tied in with is Jovian magnetic field. It's fixed in the Jovian magnetic field. And before this, nobody had the slightest idea that Jupiter had a magnetic field. So this was the first evidence that Jupiter had a magnetic
field. So that's
field.
Really the key
that's the
to
key.
It.
So the radio rotation period is determined by the rotation
It's an accurate rotation field. Period, but it didn't really matter that it was different. It just happened to be different.
That's right.
But it gave you the evidence for the magnetic
field. The optical
field.
Features are just slithering around depending on the flow of the material as well as Jupiter's rotation.
Mm-hmm.
It happens to be 10 seconds different from the radio rotation period.
Well, in these first 5 or 6 years after the discovery, what about the information about the Jovian magnetosphere and so forth?
Well, it was the first evidence that Jupiter had a magnetosphere. Of course, it wasn't proven that the magnetic field, we all postulated that Jupiter must have a magnetic field to produce this polarized radiation and to have a fixed rotation period. But it wasn't really proven conclusively that the magnetic field was indeed there until the microwave observations of Jupiter were made, the decimetric.
Polarization and decimetric wavelengths.
Yeah, and there they could actually map out the magnetic, magnetosphere.
Right.
And so we had postulated there was a magnetosphere. Well, they proved it was there, proved conclusively that it was there.
Was it the lack of angular resolution? If you'd had enough angular resolution at that time, would that have shown it?
No, because the decametric emission doesn't occur in a clearly mapped region. It clears and occurs in little hot spots on this, up above the ionosphere, and these mm-hmm. are transitory. So we still haven't been able to map yeah. Jupiter. We're yeah. still trying to do it, by the way.
So the decametric was really the key to that.
Yeah, so I say the biggest contribution was making people aware that there was a magnetic field.
Right. What about, once again, up to this period, did it provide any insight into the nature of the interaction between the solar wind and magnetospheres?
Well, we certainly looked for it, but we didn't get any correlation.
So you just didn't
have because anything. The reason, it later turned out, is that the magnetic field is so strong that it acts like an impermeable shell to the solar wind. Now, Saturn's field is much weaker. And so there's a much closer correlation between solar wind events and Saturn's mm-hmm. radio emission because mm-hmm. the solar wind can get in. But Jupiter's held off by this magnetopause, magnetosheath.
Now, one thing we haven't discussed is the spectrum of the Jovian bursts and so forth. You
right.
had a 62, you have an article, observations in Florida, Chile, and Australia. Did you go to Australia?
Was yes. That... I was invited to go down to Australia and spent to look over Shane's old data. Shane had died, and so I went down and tried to get something out of, some additional out of his data.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was down there, we built some more arrays and made observations down there at 10 megahertz.
All the way from 5 to 85.
That's right. At the same time, we used the old Mills Cross.
Oh, yes, I see. That's what you
85.
Used.
We got absolutely nothing from that.
Right.
From 85, and we got a whole lot of data from the 10 megahertz array.
Well, that's what I was wanted to ask you about. The statement in the abstract said that you've established that the cutoff in the radiation happened somewhere between 28 and 85
right.
megacycles. And I had thought that by that time that it was pretty well established that it was around 40.
Well, Warwick actually showed that it was 40 with his swept frequency devices.
At what time?
I don't remember.
Sometime after this, apparently, you're saying. This was 62 AJ
yeah,
abstract.
Probably about the same time.
Okay, so I had thought that was established much earlier, but it wasn't.
Well, maybe it was. Let's see. If it was, I don't know why we said it.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So I'm probably wrong. I'll have to just
check.
Well,
Warwick may have reported it before that, but maybe I don't know why we said it. I suspect he had done it well before that.
When that cutoff was established, what was made of that in the beginning?
Well, it was fairly... I guess magnetic field was, by then, it was fairly definite that Jupiter had a magnetic field. So Warwick and others interpreted that correctly, namely that 40 megahertz, the place where the electron gyro frequency is 40 megahertz is the place where the magnetic field is strongest, namely close to the surface. So it can't go any higher than
mm-hmm.
that.
And was there no doubt from pretty early on that it was gyro radiation?
No. This was one of the first...
This is part of the evidence.
The polarization indicated it could have been gyro radiation, and several of us had said that it was. In fact, I predicted if it was gyro radiation, it was indicated a magnetic field strength of about 10 gauss.
Mm-hmm.
And then the finding of the 40 megahertz cutoff fitted right in with that idea.
Do you remember any of the other ideas that were bouncing around as to what the mechanisms could be?
Oh, well, let's see. Shane, I believe, and Burke and Franklin talked about volcanic activity. They thought maybe the source was under the ionosphere.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we said in that connection, that's where our mentioning of the ionosphere occurred. I think we must have said it came from above the ionosphere, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Since you came into radio astronomy through a rather different path from most people, not different in that you were in electronics and radar, but later in your career and so
right.
forth, I'd be interested in any comments you have on the nature of the field at that time in the late 50s and its degree of sophistication or its just the general ambience of how it worked relative to other areas that you're familiar with then or afterwards.
Well, it was the kind of radio astronomy we got into was one of the few things where you could get started on a shoestring.
Mm-hmm.
And that, as I said, is the main reason we started in this particular branch of radio astronomy.
Did you nevertheless have close contacts with people like the microwave people in NRL?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Harvard 2170?
They were all interested in our results, more so in those days than they are now. Now we're in a backwater. People have lost interest in this. But we haven't.
What about the reported results that John Krauss had of bursts from Venus and comets?
We certainly looked at Venus.
Did you try to follow that up?
We tried to follow it up, and we didn't get any evidence of anything at all.
And did you ever look at comets?
We looked at comets. Got nothing. I think maybe in print somewhere we said we might have gotten something from a comet, mm-hmm. but it was sure it was interference.
And
we looked at everything we could and saw nothing in every case.
Is that what you would suspect happened to Krauss also?
There's so many chances for terrestrial interference.
Mm-hmm.
And terrestrial interference comes in all sorts of obscure forms and is easily mistaken for Jupiter bursts or anything else.
Right. Ironically, just today we've heard reports from Ohio State of
SETI
signals at somewhat higher frequencies.
Well, Krauss regretted having published that about Venus.
Mm-hmm.
But he made up for it later.
Are there any other things I should know about the Florida group in these first 5 years?
I guess we were the first to call the sources, principal source regions in central meridian longitude are now well known as sources A, B, and C. I think we get
that nomenclature.
Nomenclature.
Right.
And I guess we helped fill out the picture over many years. I don't know that any one discovery was uniquely due to us. Of course, the big discovery of Io's presence was very big, and he wasn't even an astronomer. He was a meteorologist.
The relationship to the traditional astronomy community, did you find that went well when you talked to
that they had very good relations with the traditional optical community, and that ends the interview with him on 19th June.